Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and today's blockbuster Supreme Court decision news is, well, maybe not that much of a blockbuster. This is how it works, though. Sometimes the court doesn't fit the tidy narratives that we've gamed out in advance. But that doesn't mean that today's ruling in the case of Fisher versus the University of Texas at Austin doesn't have major implications for affirmative action and higher education in this country. Just this morning, the Supreme Court vacated the circuit court decision and sent Fisher back to a lower court. But in the decision to pass on a ruling, what has the court really said? Jeffrey Stone of the University of Chicago is here with us to help us understand. Professor Stone, welcome back to WNYC.
Delighted to be here.
So we have this sort of non-decision on affirmative action. Justice Kennedy, writing the majority opinion, 7-1, said he was sending it back to a lower court, quote, so that the admissions process can be considered and judged under a correct analysis. What the heck does that mean?
So the central issue that people thought was at stake in Fisher is whether the court was finally, the conservative justices were finally going to say definitively that the consideration of race in college admissions, or for that matter, more generally in affirmative action, is per se unconstitutional. That's the position, for example, that Justice Clarence Thomas took in his concurring opinion in this case. And the question that most people thought was going to be resolved in Fisher was that one. And there was very good reason to believe or to fear or to hope, depending on your view, that the court was going to embrace that position and essentially say that affirmative action was per se unconstitutional going forward. The court didn't do that. Instead, Justice Kennedy interpreted the court's earlier decision in the Grutter case, in which the court had, in fact, upheld, with the vote of Justice O'Connor, who was then on the court, the University of Michigan's affirmative action program. And in Grutter, the court had basically said that affirmative action is unconstitutional unless the state can demonstrate that it satisfies what the court calls strict scrutiny. That is, that there's a very compelling justification for considering race. In this case, what the lower court did was to uphold an affirmative action program, finding that there was sufficient justification for considering race in the situation presented at the University of Texas. And the court, in an opinion by Justice Kennedy today, basically said, well, the lower court didn't apply exactly the right standard. And it applied a standard that was a little too deferential to the university. And that, in fact, the court needs to be much more skeptical in deciding whether there's an adequate justification for affirmative action, and therefore sent it back to the lower court to apply what the court now says is the right standard. And that's a standard that is, in fact, I think it's fair to say, more demanding on the state than the court had suggested in Grutter. But still doesn't go quite as far as Justice Thomas wanted to go, which would outlaw affirmative action completely. So yeah, it was a compromise decision.
In fact, one thing really interesting to me is this key quote from the decision, again, written by Justice Kennedy. The reviewing court must ultimately be satisfied that no workable race-neutral alternatives would produce the educational benefits of diversity. That no workable race-neutral alternatives would produce the educational benefits of diversity. So that holds out affirmative action as an extreme last resort. But on the other hand, doesn't it generally mean that the court also endorsed the idea that there are educational benefits inherent to diversity?
The court doesn't dispute that. It has always acknowledged that. At least the majority of the justices have always acknowledged that. That is legitimate. The question is whether the government can achieve it by consideration of race. So Justice Kennedy's position has always been that that's a legitimate goal, but the government cannot achieve it by considering race directly unless there's no other way of getting there. And so basically Kennedy's position has been that if there's any other way to achieve diversity, you can't take race into account. So an example of that is what the University of Texas already does. The University of Texas basically admits students in the top 10% of the high school graduating class. And the reason they do that is to promote diversity. If they consider the usual admissions criteria, then the University of Texas' concern is that they would not have very many minority students. And therefore, instead of that, they automatically admit anyone in the top 10% of the class, which was designed to produce a certain degree of diversity. And that's the kind of approach Kennedy wants to see as a way of achieving diversity, rather than actually considering the race of any particular student. And the question here is the University of Texas say, okay, we did that. Right, we admitted the top 10% of every class. Nonetheless, the reality we have is inadequate diversity. And therefore, the only way we can get to the diversity we need and we want and we value is by considering race in some cases. And the court basically said, well, we're not persuaded. You've got to present a stronger case than you have thus far that there aren't race-neutral ways of getting there. And clearly what Kennedy wants to do is to eliminate the use of race completely, but to try to do it in a way that suggests that there's always the possibility of considering it in the extreme situation in which there's no other way to get to diversity. But he's not really very open to the idea of ever using race.
And this decision just came down in the last hour, but I'm already reading two different interpretations with respect to the burden of proof, which is really, I guess, what you're talking about. And one is that the Supreme Court essentially told the lower court, this is your new standard. If you can't find a workable, race-neutral alternative, then this policy must be upheld. The other interpretation is that the burden is on the university. If you can't defend your policy, then it has to go. That is, can't defend your policy by showing that you've tried every possible race-neutral path to diversity. So is it one or the other?
It's the latter. Clearly, what the court has said is that the burden is on the university to demonstrate in a very convincing manner that it has exhausted every possible way of achieving diversity without considering race specifically, and only then will the state be allowed to consider race and affirmative action. So clearly what this decision was about was who has the burden of proof and how great the burden of proof is. And what the court did is interpret Grutter, the earlier decision, in a way that suggests that there's a very high burden of proof on the state to demonstrate that it has exhausted all other mechanisms before it turns to the consideration of race.
So that's exactly
what the court has done here.
So if I can ask you to speculate, is this the middle of the beginning of the end of affirmative action? In other words, how do you think this will come out once they send it back?
I think it'll come out saying that it was the program was unconstitutional. I think that's the message the court is sending unequivocally. And we're doing it's Kennedy basically is doing a dance here. I mean, he's reluctant to go the whole route that, say, Justice Thomas has explicitly endorsed, that consideration of race is per se unconstitutional. But he's stating a burden of proof that's so high that it's virtually impossible, I suspect, under his conception of the burden of proof, for a university to meet it.
Why did Ginsburg dissent if the other liberal justices went along?
Ginsburg dissented because clearly, in her view, the proper application of Grutter and the proper interpretation of the 14th Amendment gives the university, the state, a greater degree of flexibility to decide to use race in order to achieve diversity. I suspect that Breyer and Sotomayor went along to avoid an outcome that would have said race can never be used. So my guess is, and I have no way of knowing this for sure, but my guess is that Breyer and Sotomayor went along as a compromise because essentially the Kennedy and the other conservatives were suggesting that race can never be used. They didn't want that, and Kennedy gave them room for agreement if he had a substantial majority for his position. So that's my guess.
And it was 7-1. That's 8, not 9 votes. Kagan didn't participate?
Kagan did not participate, right. Kagan did not participate because the issue arose when she was Solicitor General.
You flagged two other decisions for us this morning, one on Title VII, which you characterize as pro-business. Effectively, the court said today that the employee harassment protections under the Civil Rights Act don't apply to someone who isn't a supervisor. So basically, a coworker can treat you however they want if they don't have the authority to actually threaten your job. Is that it?
Correct. And the other, there's another Title VII case in which the court basically said that, the standard for proving discrimination in an employment discrimination case now has to be but for. In other words, the plaintiff has to prove that they would have been hired but for the consideration of race or gender or religion, which is a different standard than had been the prevailing test below, which was that discrimination was one motivation among others in the decision not to hire someone. So both of these cases are 5-4, the conservatives on one side, the moderate liberals on the other side. They both changed the law from what people had generally understood it to be before in a way that narrows the opportunity for people to get relief for employment discrimination against them. They're both clearly pro-business, and they're reminiscent of the Lilly Ledbetter decision several years ago, in which the court, in that case, narrowly construed anti-discrimination in employment laws. And Congress eventually had to reverse that decision by amending the statute. And that's what Justice Ginsburg, in her dissenting opinion, suggests that Congress should do again. These are clearly strong pro-business decisions at the expense of anti-discrimination laws. And they divide the court, you know, perfectly, 5-4, conservatives on one side, moderate liberals on the other side, and it's kind of a replay of the Lilly Ledbetter division.
Jeff Stone from the University of Chicago talking about the Supreme Court rulings today. And before you go, I want to ask about one other piece of news from this morning, the court or I. The court decided to hear a challenge this fall that President Obama's recess appointments are unconstitutional. And we'll admit that the first thing we did was Google, are recess appointments constitutional? And so lo and behold, in Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution, we have this, quote, the president shall have the power to fill up all vacancies that may happen during the recess of the Senate by granting commissions which shall expire at the end of their next session. So why is the Supreme Court hearing such a case?
So the question is, what is a recess? Traditionally, recess appointments could be made whenever the Senate was in recess. What's happened since Obama has been elected president is that the Republicans have basically prevented the existence of recess in circumstances where everybody goes home. Which normally, historically, would be a recess. What they've done is to leave one senator to hang around every once in a while to say a few words to claim that the Senate is not in recess. And so the Senate never votes to go into recess because that senator is hanging around doing his little thing. And the Obama administration said that's illegitimate. That's a gimmick. That's not that doesn't prevent the Senate from effectively being in recess. And so Obama appointed several nominees during that period. And the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia said, that's not a recess. Their Senate is still, in theory, in operation. And that's the question before the Supreme Court. What is the meaning of recess under the Constitution?
How small a break can you use to slip in a nomination that couldn't get confirmed by the Senate?
Well, I put it the other way. It's not how small a break, but to what extent can the Senate actually recess but pretend it's not recessing by using a kind of fraudulent device to prevent recess appointments?
So we've got just a minute left. There are still two huge decisions outstanding, three really, because there are two on gay marriage, the Defense of Marriage Act and California's Proposition 8, plus the fate of the Voting Rights Act, or a key part of it. And we're now being told that the court will be back at 10 a.m. tomorrow morning. They usually do these things only on Mondays and Thursdays. So the watch continues. Any thoughts on why they had to add a new session tomorrow instead of getting it all done, you know, with the usually scheduled amount?
I think they still have six opinions left, and that's more than they would ordinarily want to announce in one day. So my guess is that they'll do some of them tomorrow and some on Thursday. But other than that, they could do all six in one day if the opinions are all done.
Right. They said tomorrow, and they seem to have said tomorrow, and
well, we don't know what the next day will be, but
then,
usually it's Thursday.
And then a new session. So,
right, we don't know when that'll
probably
be.
Probably two more. All right, so we right. will see. And, folks, we will be back here tomorrow, as we've been doing on all these session days, being ready to break down the Supreme Court rulings, which do come down right around 10 a.m. at the start of our show. We thank again Jeffrey Stone, law professor at the University of Chicago. Thank you so, so much.
My pleasure.
And, folks, we'll talk to you tomorrow with more Supreme Court rulings and more. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.